And so, okay, good, broad, basic guidelines, yeah? Nothing much to disagree with there. But we need to target them a bit more specifically, don't we? We need to then be a bit clearer about how we apply those principles through our lives. And that's where we get to these 10 precepts that we looked at earlier on, we chanted earlier on, or some of us did anyway. And the reason I've chosen this list, this is not the usual list you would be introduced to as our first introduction to Buddhist ethics. You'd normally be introduced to a list of 5 precepts, the first 4 of the ones we're going to look at today, and a slightly different 5th one, which I'll come back to. But I've chosen this list of 10 precepts, which are the precepts that are taken when one is ordained and that one recites when one's an order member, because they more closely reflect this relationship with the cock, the snake, and the pig. So the last 3 are of undertaking the training principle of abstention from covetousness, of abstention from animosity, or abstention from wrong views. And the positive side of them, I think, kind of sums them up very well, doesn't it? Abandoning covetousness for tranquility, I purify my mind. Changing hatred into compassion, I purify my mind. Transforming ignorance into wisdom, I purify my mind. Yeah, so that's working, in a way, most of the time, we're not on the ball enough to work directly with our minds. We can do that when we're meditating. As you develop, as one develops a greater degree of self-awareness, as it were, then one is a bit more on the ball and one is able to work more directly on one mind. Most of the time, personally, I'm functioning on the level of just trying not to snap at people, you know, just sort of trying to work from my behaviour in, as it were. So I think I've said this before, haven't I? But again, it's worth repeating. As well as our actions of body, our actions of speech being a reflection of what's going on in our mind, and we can work through meditation directly on the mind, yeah? When we sit in meditation, we're using the mind to work on the mind directly. We can also affect what goes on with our mind by changing our behaviour, yeah? We can retrain our mind the other way in, as it were. So by, well, we'll look at how we can do that, how we express that, but by being careful about how we speak, by being careful about what we do, we can start to operate in that feedback system between our actions and our mental states, yeah? So that we work to refine our consciousnesses indirectly. Which is why, for example, we do things like yoga in the building and stuff like that. Yeah, there are other ways of working indirectly to refine the mind. The only time in my life that I have felt like I was actively working on the mind precepts was towards the end of my ordination retreat. So I'd been on retreat for, well, it was a 4-month-long retreat. And probably through the last month or so of that, I was sufficiently calm and settled and aware through a very simple practice of you know, being on retreat for a very long time, to feel like I was really able to work ethically at a mind level. Yeah, most of the rest of the time, I'm far too scattered to get to that. So the other 7 precepts break down into 4 which are about speech and 3 which are about actions. Should we do the actions first? Yeah, let's do the actions first. So I'll read through those. With deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. With open-handed generosity, I purify my body. With stillness, simplicity, and contentment, I purify my body. So what we're moving away from here is from taking life. Yeah, we move away from causing harm more broadly to acting with loving kindness. From moving away from taking that which is not freely given towards generosity. and moving away from sexual or more broadly sensual misconduct towards stillness, simplicity and contentment. So you can see these are fairly direct expressions of working against craving and hatred here. What can I say about that? I'll come back to the thing about loving kindness later. It's kind of it's on one level it's quite obvious. On another level it's quite profound, and I've got a point I'll make about that at the end, the more sort of profound side of that. In terms of, it's worth mentioning that, you know, most Buddhists, although not all, are vegetarians. Yeah? Taking life is a very obvious way of causing harm, and so most Buddhists seek to avoid doing that. To the extent that they're able, for, you know, health reasons or practical reasons. It's less of a big deal, for example, it wasn't that strong a thing in Tibet, for example, because the dietarily they didn't really have that much, they didn't have the same degree of choice of people who lived in more clement environments. I think the whole business of moving away from taking the not given towards generosity, it's a very nice way of putting it, isn't it? It's very taking that which is not freely given. I think one of the things I like about that is that it covers things like people's time and energy. I'm sure we all know people who we feel sometimes demand of us more than we are happy to give them. And I expect we can all recognise times when we've done the same thing to people. But I think it gets round the kind of loopholes that one can have in terms of stealing or whatever, stuff like that. It's quite clear, for example, that... there's a lovely story which we were just talking about a little bit about Rumi and Sufism earlier on, weren't we? I'll tell you a story from the Sufi tradition, actually, which demonstrates... demonstrates the whole point. The duties to one's fellows are very strong. There's a text called The Duties of Brotherhood in Islam, which we've sometimes studied in the movement. And there's a story in the Sufi tradition about a chap going away and leaving his friend to look after his stuff, as it were. And whilst the first chap is away, his friend comes in and helps himself. The first chap's servants see this chap come in and help himself to a large quantity of gold from the treasury of the first chap. And what happens is when the master comes back, as it were, the servants go to grass up this guy's mate for having sort of pinched his money, and actually they don't get the response they're expecting. The chap is delighted and sings with delight and dances around, and the servants obviously are completely confused by this, and what on earth's going on here. And the point that the guy makes, I'm not telling the story very well, I'm sorry about this, but never mind. The point, I'll cut to the chase, the point that the guy makes is that he's really delighted that his brother, you know, his friend, knows that if he's in a scrape, he can help himself to his friend's stuff, and know that he's open to do that, as it were. You know, the level of friendship between them is that they trust each other to do that which they need to do, whatever the circumstances, and that he's really pleased that his friend is close enough to him to know that that would be all right for him to help himself if he needed it. Does that make an impression? So we have to know, obviously, we have to have a very good idea whether what we're taking would be freely given, as it were. Sometimes you make a guess and you get it wrong, but... Anyway, yeah, moving away from not taking that, from abstention from taking that which is not freely given, towards the development of generosity. And then there's this whole area of sexual misconduct. So there's a traditional list that goes with this from 2,500 years ago in India, which is all about abduction and selling people as slaves and things like that, which are, it's perhaps, well, actually it still goes on, but fortunately perhaps not to the same degree that it once did. The key point really is of not using any form of coercion or manipulation in our relationships. So that's not using power, be it physical or emotional or financial or whatever, yeah. Not manipulating others in our romantic relationships, in our sexual relationships. Of course, it also broadens out. If the positive side is that we're cultivating stillness, simplicity, and contentment, and those that applies across the whole of our life, as it were, not just in the bedroom in its broader metaphorical sort of sense. So it's this tendency to want to acquire things, as it were, and to be to be discontent, to always want more. And we live in a society which is based almost exclusively on the cultivation of discontent and of the cultivation of us wanting more things. Which is very good if you're buying things from our shop, very bad if you're buying them from anyone else. So those are the precepts for the body. And then there are four precepts to do with speech. This is often commented on, but the most, there's three to do with the mind, which is actually the hardest place to work in a way. Three to do with the body, and four to do with speech. And that's because speech is, it just comes out, doesn't it? The space between thought and speech is often, it's almost like the thought comes afterwards quite often, isn't it? And it's kind of like, it's out there and it's like, oh, look what's out there. The Tibetans are said to call the tongue the axe in the mouth. Yeah, sometimes called the knife in the mouth. It's a very savage weapon, the tongue, and we can often wield it mercilessly. It's very difficult to be completely considered about what one says.